So you asked kind of what are some of the key points along the way. And I would say that to categorize it, there was kind of three prongs on adaptive management that were moving forward simultaneously from about 1985 forward. This was after we got the first that we first started to look at the Grand Canyon and the operations of the dam after the high flows of 83 and 84 and 85. Part of it was, and those three prongs are the scientific prong of it moving forward, the administrative prong of it, which is the executive review committee and the agencies associated with that. And then the third piece would be the public piece of that. Because we were educating, we're bringing the public along with us in this, and especially after NEPA was started in 89, after we started to have public meetings and the public was part of the process now. You couldn't shut them out anymore. In fact, for the first NEPA scoping meeting that was held in Flagstaff, Arizona, by the Bureau of Reclamation, got about 10 minutes into it, and they had to shut it down because there was not, the fire marshal came in and said, "You got too many people in the high school, Flagstaff High School auditorium." That was the interest the public had in this because the public had been pushed down so long by the Bureau. The old adage, "The Bureau buildeth, the Bureau taketh away," continued. That was their philosophy. And so those were the three prongs. So let me speak to that. First off, I think scientifically, the genesis of the adaptive management really began with when we brought the National Academy of Science on board. This first report in 1987 was, and it was titled "A Review of the Bureau of Reclamation's Glen Canyon Environmental Studies." It was hard on us for all the right reasons because we had started out in the planning and management of this, I'll just say, they basically said you're weak on your objectives and articulating them. You know, things like that. The science could be improved upon. The whole process that you're moving forward on trying to do good science around this set of questions is not scientifically supportable. Harsh to hear if you're an agency scientist who's been down in 115 degree heat pulling nets in the Grand Canyon, but absolutely necessary. It made us grow up, and it became better because of that. Subsequent review, and I guess the genesis for adaptive management began with that, because we all of a sudden said we're not going to be able to understand and give specifics on everything that the government wants us to give on. So we're going to have to figure out a way to how to do monitoring that will feed back into this. And I didn't use the terms adaptive management at that point, but that's exactly what it was. We had to start thinking of that. The next big effort that we did, we held a symposium in 1990 in Santa Fe for the Colorado River Ecology and Dam Management. We brought together, again, high-level scientists and National Academy of Science folks to not only continue the review of what we were doing in the Colorado River, but to kind of get us over that next hump. And that's, again, and now adaptive management begins to be talked about in that terminology. And then, of course, we get into the final one they did for me, and they did two more after this, but river resource management in the Grand Canyon. And this, from a scientific, is where it's embraced full bore. You know, this is where adaptive management all of a sudden becomes the element that then ultimately gets embraced in the Grand Canyon Protection Act in Section 1805. So this is the science prong of adaptive management. So you ask for where are the kind of the documents that articulate that, it's there. Administratively, we began the process. This was the final report in 1988. So this is May of 1988. I would say the first time
that's the Grand Canyon Environmental Studies final report.
This is the Executive Review Committee. This is what was leading us up to the EIS. So this was the Executive Review Committee. It was all the Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife, and I had put this together because I kept getting calls from all the various agencies, regional, and these were all regional directors. These were not delegated to some staffer down in the bottom of the totem pole. The RDs would come to these meetings and be briefed by us. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. This is the people we're coordinating with. As an example, when Cliff Barrett was commissioner, was regional director of the Bureau of Reclamation in Salt Lake City, Upper Colorado region, once a month, we would take the Bureau jet, Aero Commander, down to L.A., to meet with Dennis Underwood, who was then head of Metropolitan Water District. You don't think that the Bureau of Reclamation, what we did at Glen Canyon, was important to California? Every month, we'd fly down to L.A. And have a one-on-one briefing, regional director to the head of Metropolitan Water District, and me telling them what we're doing on the river and what the implications were, potential implications were to river management. So the administrators early on knew. They had a gut feeling. Once you tip one domino on NEPA and the Colorado River system, it's going to go upstream and downstream. And it did. Not only in terms of operations, but in terms of the fish programs. Now, prior to this, when I was working in Fort Collins, going to graduate school, it was then called the Colorado River Fish Program. It's now evolved into the Recovery Implementation Program. But then it was just the fish program, and there were two of us, Mike Pruitt, who did the Colorado River side, and me, who did the Green River side. And we were out every month taking measurements on the Colorado River or the Green River as related to endangered fish. So
ever work with Minkley?
Chuck and Wendell.
Okay.
I know both of them quite well. I knew Wendell when he was still alive. He and I actually flew up to Duncan's Ranch in Montana for several meetings. Duncan spent the summers. They have a family ranch that borders on Yellowstone National Park. Bought it in 49 or 50, his parents did. I mean, it is right. Yellowstone is across the Madison River, and there's Duncan's ranch. So we met up there, well, for obvious reasons, several times. But anyway, part of this was that the Executive Review Committee, this is where I started giving, and I would be asked to come in and make reports to these, and then they would go into discussion over how they as a group would implement what we were asking them to do in terms of flows, in terms of permitting, in terms of operational packages, etc. This is the group that I first gave a report to on adaptive management in 1987. So I laid it out to them as an administrator, as administrators, regional directors for these agencies. This is what the concept is all about. And we might want to start thinking about how we implement something. So the genesis on the administrative side was 1987. And it was embraced in 88 in this document. So this is coming forward. And this ultimately becomes then the NEPA. Because these are the agencies who are the elements of the NEPA. These are the federal agencies who are the action agencies for NEPA. So the concept that we laid out here moves forward with that.
Can you clarify briefly why you think the Bureau of Reclamation was so disinterested in doing NEPA compliance and doing a full-blown environmental impact statement?
Simple. Easy. Because they'd never done NEPA on Glen Canyon before. And forever, David Brower and the conservation community had just blasted the Bureau for Glen Canyon Dam. And they knew, and David Brower was still alive at this point and doing, you know, David Brower stuff, and the public was getting hammered. Every boatman of any magnitude in the Grand Canyon, if they didn't have a pack of postcards in their ammo can when they went downstream and gave it to every one of their clients who were, or customers who were on the trip and said, send this into the Bureau of Reclamation, we need to do a new change in the operations of the dam, or we're losing our beaches. So some of the biggest champions of getting to NEPA was the river community. forever I'll be indebted to the Bowman down there, because the ones who really cared, they worked their customers hard to talk to them about the impacts the dam was having. So you talk about education. The boatmen were educating the public who were on every river trip. And so the Bureau, knowing that Glen Canyon Dam was having such a huge impact downstream, but also knowing they had the law of the river and all these constraints that they've lived by for years and years and years and years to operate the dam, and knowing that no other dam on the Colorado River system had gone through NEPA compliance. If one does, the dominoes start falling. So Flaming Gorge subsequently has had it, the Kerr County units had NEPA compliance. We've had NEPA compliance on almost all the upper basin dams now that feed the system.
And is it that the result of doing the scientific studies on the environmental impacts ends up altering dam management in a way that the Bureau of Reclamation simply did not
want? And you go to any of the old engineers and they'll tell you, this is an inefficient way to run the dam. The best way to run the dam, and I remember having this discussion clearly, we were doing the 25th anniversary. Cliff Barrett was regional director at the top of Glen Canyon Dam. Rose Mumford was governor. And we were doing this big ceremony up there, and I had been asked to come up and say a few words. And I took one of the old engineers who was there when the dam was first operated, and I said, how did you come up with what the flow releases should be at the dam? You know, because they said, well, depending on how much water is in the reservoir, we want to ramp it up to exactly that hot level. So we maximize the head we have on the reservoir to make the maximum amount of electricity possible. I said, well, that's great. That makes sense. How did you determine the low end? Well, if it was our desire, we would just turn it off at night. But we couldn't do that because the environmental folks would go ballistic if there wasn't some water in the river. So the whole context of it, we looked over the side until we saw about the water, you know, we could see water coming out of the base of the dam. That was our minimum flow. That's where 2000 CFS came from. It wasn't some scientific study. It was some dam engineer looking over the top of the dam and saying, we got to have something in there. Let's put a little
looks
water.
Like enough.
Looks like enough. Exactly. Looks like enough. That's the way the Bureau operated. And that's how the dam engineers were looking at efficiency. From their mind, from their perspective, that was the smart way to run these things, up and down. You know, and then because it's a peaking plant, you can spool it up you can spool up those generators in 3 minutes, where Navajo generating stations takes 24 hours to spool that generator up on the steam plant. 3 minutes. You can bring it from zero to full bore. That's how they should operate it.
So you're saying the Bureau of Reclamation, which is a irrigation agency, which happens to fund itself through hydropower revenues,
but
has completely turned into a power agency by the 1980s.
Because that's what pays the bills.
That's what pays the bills.
It's the Glen Canyon Dam. Think of the Colorado Storage Project as a huge Christmas tree. And there's a bunch of ornaments out there, and those are all the small dams and such. There's one ginormous ornament that sits right on the very top, Glen Canyon Dam. That's the checkbook. And that pays for everything. So, yeah, the Bureau went from irrigation, and they still are, to this is how we fund our agency. And that's exactly how they do it, and that's what they try to maximize. And they were very good at it for many, many years.
So essentially any program, including just a research program, that threatened to make their revenue interests less efficient, that threatened to make the dam less efficient as a revenue generator,
or cause electricity to cost more,
was something that they would resist.
And especially on the Colorado system, because all those reservoirs and dams are part of the Colorado River Storage Project.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were, let's just say you were the Klamath Project, you can't tap into CRSP revenues. It has to be projects that are pertinent to CRSP. That's why we had the checkbook, or access to the checkbook for CRSP. And then part of this also was in 1977, when WAPA and the Bureau, you know, when they got a divorce, so to speak, and the Bureau, all the power marketing piece went over to the WAPA,
mm-hmm.
and the Bureau then just became the operational piece. So there was, who populated WAPA in the first 10 years? It was just Bureau people.
Bureau people.
Moved across the street to WAPA. So the mindset, the culture remained the same. And it's the culture of the Bureau of Reclamation we're fighting more than anything else. And that's that culture that has not, even though they do have some good biologists and scientists they brought on board, they are not, they're there because they have to be there. They're not there because the Bureau wants them there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just their culture is we build dams and we operate dams. That's what we do. We don't do science. We don't do biology. We don't do this other stuff.
We don't manage for multiple values and multiple resources.
Multi-purpose in terms of hydropower and water delivery, but not for recreation, not for humpback chub, not for houseboats on Lake Powell. That's not part of our recreational job.
So is this all part of the story of the 1960s and 1970s environmental era in which these other values are
finding
their
way? All changed, yeah. And that goes back to, I don't want to lose my train of thought on the third piece, but let me give you this tangent.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to when I was released from the Bureau in 96. The very first phone call I received, the very first phone call, was from David Brower. And he called up and said, there's a plane ticket waiting for you at the, I think it was Delta Airlines in Flagstaff. I want you to come to Berkeley. I'm going to start educating you on what happened back in the 60s, 50s and 60s. He lived at 40 Stevenson Avenue in the hills above Berkeley. In fact, his home, I think, is going to actually be on the National Historic Register now.
Mm.
Because his kids still own it. They bought it back, and they're going to do something with it. He had a garage full of David Brower, Ansel Adams, all that history that he is part of, and David being part of the 10th Mountain Division, Sierra Club, and all that. So for 7 days, I sat in his garage, and he would just keep bringing out stuff. He and his wife, Ann, who was still alive, on all the history of the Sierra Club and his battles on dinosaur and all that. So getting educated by David Brower and understanding the context he was coming from in that world in the late 50s, early 60s, Echo Park, Wallace Stegner, Bernard DeVoto, all those people, and David had all that literature. And I think most of it's in the Bancroft now. I hope it's in the Bancroft. Though I know a lot of it is still in the garage, because I talked to Ken Brower, his son, and Ken said, there's still a bunch of stuff here. You really need to come and go through this. So I got to do that sometime. But the other piece of this, though, is after I left the Bureau, I started to become outspoken a bit on how the Bureau was continuing to operate the facility and how you couldn't just do periodic floods and expect that everything's going to be hunky-dory in the Grand Canyon. What we learned from the flood is that you can move sediment, but the moment you go back to operations, normal operations, those beaches are going to go. There's only so much, unless you increase amounts. So out of all that discussion, and Dan Beard pushed me into this to some extent, he said, you know, you need to go out there and speak on these issues. So I did, but I began to get on the dais with Floyd Dominey often. Floyd being the former commissioner of the Bureau, and to his mind, until he died, Floyd was the commissioner, in quotes, of the Bureau of Reclamation. The Bureau's greatest days were when Floyd was commissioner. And, you know, he operated in a whole different world. He operated in a sense that he was bigger than the Secretary of Interior in many respects. And he was building dams all over the place, and there was no NEPA, there was no ESA. Nothing he had to worry about. He just had to build dams. And Floyd was really good at getting people motivated to build dams, Glen Canyon being his pride and joy. So we'd often be debating about the value of Glen Canyon. Well, out of that, we would end every evening, usually, at a bar someplace. And we started to have a friendship out of this. So out of that, Floyd invited myself and my wife to his house in the state of Virginia. And so we'd go out. We were probably at his house three or four times and did oral interviews and took him to lunch. And he started pulling out all this stuff about his side of the story. And while Stegner captured very well, captured the trip down the Grand Canyon between Brower, and Dominey. There's a whole nother story.
John McPhee's encounters with the airstrip.
I'm sorry, I got my people mixed up here. But there's the whole other story that Floyd said, before I would agree to go down the Grand Canyon with Brower, he had to agree to come do a houseboat trip with me on Lake Powell for a week, and they did. That was never written about. And so Floyd would haul out all these pictures and said, Brower had a great time on that trip, and there's these two iconic bookends of the conservation movement that I evolved into, but they were and still are the bookends. You had David Brower on one side, you had Floyd Dominey on the other side, and then you had Martin Litton, who was really the spokesperson for David. He wrote most of David's stuff.
Really?
Martin was a senior editor at the LA, what is the newspaper in LA? Times?
Times.
Okay. And then he went to become the senior editor for Sunset Magazine in Menlo Park, California. And he wrote all those travel pieces in Sunset. And that's where he got his start in the Grand Canyon with the Dories. He was writing travel pieces. And, you know, he just got... So Martin was the heart and soul of David Brower. And so those three iconic men circled me for a bunch of years. And in fact, when Floyd turned 100, I hosted his 100th birthday party on the Hill. The Department of Interior would not come to his birthday party.
Why?
Because Floyd has a somewhat soiled reputation in the Department of the Interior. You know, he was a womanizer and a hard drinker, and he came out of that era. He was a quartermaster in the Army during World War II. He was going to get things done, and he knew how to do it. So they wouldn't come, but a lot of other people peripheral did. So we had a full house on Capitol Hill for Floyd's 100th birthday. He made it to 101, passed away, but he was an amazing... I mean, I don't agree with him on what he did, but I respect him for what he did. And he was living in a certain set of ideals and was given a job to do, and he did it. I would say the same for Brower. Do I agree with his methods all the time? No. I mean, Brower could be hard on you and nasty, just as bad as Floyd could be, but he had his own way of doing business. So to have the ability to have interacted with all three of those men at that point, as I was formulating, what do we do here? So while they were pulling me in this direction, science and everything else was pulling in another direction. So now we get back to the third part, which is the education piece of this. So as the EIS began to evolve out of this, it became apparent that adaptive management was going to be part of it. And because of the way we were talking about it, I started to develop papers and dialogues that could be done. So there's a number of different things here. A blueprint for adaptive management of the Colorado River Corridor through Glen and Grand Canyon. You know, that was doing these things all the time.
Is that something you wrote back in the 80s?
I don't know what the date is on this one, but this would have probably...
Looks like it was typed.
It was a typewriter, I can tell you that. It was typewriter. So it had to be before I had a computer when I was 90.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like that. I had the Park Service was talking about having adaptive management included. So, and then Steve Carruthers, and have you talked to Steve?
Not yet. We haven't interviewed him.
You need to talk to Steve Carruthers up in Flagstaff.
Is that where he's living now?
Well, partly. I mean, he's either in Austin or he's in Flag. He's a man about the country now. But he and I actually did this document in, I don't remember who we gave this to, but... we called it a management opportunity. This was January 92. But here I laid out options for the Colorado River, adaptive management in use, the Northwest Power Act, implementation of adaptive management of the Colorado River. This actually looks computer. So Colorado River Coordination Group. So I started putting out documents like this. This is what got fed into Washington. And so, ultimately...
Were you reading people like Kai Lee at this time,
who's
articulating adaptive management?
I was... Anything I could get on this concept, I was trying to assimilate and bring back in. So, ultimately, this was put together to help explain the Grand Canyon Protection Act, because Section 1805 of the Grand Canyon Protection Act calls for long-term monitoring and such. And adaptive management is the undertow to all of that. So again, this was the education piece of members of Congress and of the political side of the agenda on why this language is in this bill at this point in time and what it means to implementation for the long term. So out of the Grand Canyon Protection Act then, that's where you saw, and you'll see this in writings, were the Everglades. When they did the, when Secretary Gore or Vice President Gore was working on the Everglades deal, that became part of the dialogue there. When they were working on the Northwest Forest Plan for the Spotted Owl, it became a part of that. When Jack Ward Thomas was Forest Service, he began to input. So there was four or five of us around the country who were kicking the concept around. We didn't quite understand what Kylie and others were. I mean, we understood the concept, but actually taking it from that concept and bringing it into action is what we were all struggling with. And not, I guess struggle is a good word. We were just trying to figure out what's that going to look like. So, and then eventually the Platte River and the Missouri River and all these other things. And now there's a whole adaptive management network that's out there that, you know, does this stuff.
Of land managers?
Well, land, water, resource managers, CAMNET, you know, it's, there's a whole bunch of professionals out there who are now, have, it's become a science of sorts, even though it's not a science, but it's, you know, it's a use of science, but it's not.
It's applied science.
It's applied science, but, so I guess to kind of tie it all together and then we can go back to your questions. It was a couple of things that came together, I would like to think for a reason, but it was, it was Jim Watt being forced to do the NEPA, to being forced to do some environmental studies at Glen Canyon Dam because the public was getting upset that what was going on and they didn't feel anybody, just like today, nobody listens to us, you know, sort of thing. It was the flood of 83 that changed the perspective from looking at it from a very narrow perspective on just two new generators on the river outlet tubes at Glen Canyon Dam to now be the whole operational. And I know when we played that out the first time, the regional director said, I don't know what this is, where this is going to take us. If I all of a sudden say, yeah, we want to look at the whole operational regime, where this may end, but let's go. To the getting that call from the secretary's office, from Reagan's people, who were in the White House at that point, saying, do you have a use for the National Academy of Sciences? And again, that money, there was $200,000 I didn't have to come up with. The Department of Interior came up with $200,000. So, you know, I had the Academy of Science at my disposal. And they, we had a meeting with them in the Phoenix Airport in the Crown Room of Terminal B, or whatever terminal the Delta flies out of. There used to be a little Crown Room down there. But that's where we held the first meeting with the Academy of Sciences. When I, and then from there, they invited me back to Washington to pitch the study to the whole Academy of Sciences. So here I am, fly from Flagstaff, Arizona, roll into Washington, D.C., go down to the main National Academy of Sciences building on Constitution Avenue there, walk inside, see the portrait of Abraham Lincoln, who started the National Academy of Sciences in the midst of the Civil War. And here I am pitching to why the Academy of Sciences should now take on the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies and the Bureau and what we're doing. I mean, that to me was one of those moments, watershed moments, where all of a sudden now we got the nation and some of the best scientists in the nation looking at these issues with us. Not day to day, but oversight, which was critical. Then getting to the lawsuit, where WAPA, Western Air Power Administration, was sued by the public over operational impacts of the way they operated the dam, and having the Bureau have to be implicit in that because they own the dam, own and operate the dam. So, and having, let's say this, Ty Cobb, who was their attorney for the plaintiff, being the aggressive person he still is, I assume that's why President Trump got him, to win that case and to force the NEPA compliance on the contracts and ultimately on the operation of the dam, to getting the operation of the dam EIS and having George Miller and Dan Beard and Bruce Babbitt all come into this at various points to help be the guardian angels they were, to make sure that we weren't done away with, which could have been done 3 or 4 times. They should have pulled the plug on the Glen Canyon environmental studies. But for whatever reason, they didn't. And then we got to 96 and had the experimental flood, and that gained a lot of credibility for the program. So on it goes. And I'm proud of everyone, most of the scientists who work for us. So they're all good folks, and we all committed to this more as a deal for the Grand Canyon than for checking a box on any agency's stuff. So, but talk to Steve, because Steve was the former scientist at Grand Canyon National Park in the late 70s. He was the guy that was shooting mules out of helicopters and that sort of thing. Well, there was a mule problem in Grand Canyon. And I think, Cleveland Amory and Friends of the Animals, or Friends of whatever it was, Friends of the Mules, got on their case. Anyway, Steve and the Park Service had a separation. Steve went on to start his own company, SWCA, in Flagstaff, which is now nationwide almost. And but Steve was, for whatever reason, and I'll forever be indebted to him, he kind of took me on as saying, you don't know much about the Grand Canyon, but I'm going to help you. I'm going to teach you. So he and the river community, several people in the river community, embraced us. And they watched out. They watched out for my scientists in the canyon. If one of my crews got in trouble, they'd be the first ones to pull over and help them. Or they'd call me and say, your crew is hung up on such and such a rock. You need to helicopter in a motor, or, you know, or bring in a new survey rod or something like that. And the river community, as we gained credibility, they embraced us.
Did he ever serve as an official representative on the adaptive management team once it became a sort of a stakeholder group?
No. I think Steve and I were both kind of ostracized from that whole process. After GCMRC came into being, we were told to go away for a lot of reasons. And some of them valid reasons, but, you know.
Do you want to talk about that?
I don't know if it's important to the adaptive management story you're telling. It's a story, and it's a long story, so probably not now.
Perhaps another time.
But there is, and I would definitely encourage you to talk to Steve, because he was the guy who encouraged me to keep pushing and writing on adaptive management. Just because he knew it was going to be different. It was going to be a game changer. And I think if there's one thing in the EIS that is the game changer, it's adaptive management. It's the embracing of adaptive management. Now, how it's been applied, I don't necessarily always agree with. But the original intent and the fact that it's in the Grand Canyon Protection Act and in the EIS and it's in the Record of Decision, to me, is something that we can all be proud of.
Was Steve involved in helping to get the Grand Canyon Protection Act introduced and...
No, I mean, he's always peripherally out there.
So,
in terms of the fact that he and I would get together and go running up Humphreys Peak to relieve ourselves of various stresses, yeah, I'd say he was probably one of the most important people who you'll never hear about in Grand Canyon depth. Because of the fact that the role he's played has always been behind the scenes, but I know I never would have been able to do what I did without Steve Carruthers in the background. Absolutely would never have gotten it done. Because when it was the low of lows, when I was getting hammered by DC or the agencies, Steve would always find an encouraging word to say to keep the discussion going. He and Dottie House, who was the librarian at the Museum of Northern Arizona before they let her go, she became Steve's go-to person. He hired her, a smart man. Smartest movie ever made was to hire Dottie, because she knows how to write. And she can write EI. She can do everything that Steve needs to have written. But Steve and Dottie, I would go to the ends of the earth for them, because of ultimately at the very, if you look at the core of what kept the egg incubating, it was Steve Carruthers. Absolutely. So you really need to talk to him.
All right. Yeah, we have several more years of interviews to do, and we have a growing list of people to interview,
okay.
And I will put him on the list and contact him.
You should. Okay.
Can I ask you to think broadly about the value of the program over time? So sometimes there's a little controversy over how much money is being spent on research and what is the value of that research and what has been accomplished by the program. And I'm very interested in leaving a legacy.
Absolutely.
Of people who have been around for a long time who have something to say about the value of the program over time, what it's accomplished, why should it be continued, and if so, why?
Well, first off, I'll answer your last question. Should it be continued? It's absolutely yes. You need to understand what the impacts of the dam are as much as you need to know how that spinning widget in the dam impacts how much electricity can be made.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's an integrated, essential component of any management of a federal facility, whether it's a dam, power plant, irrigation system, you name it. You have to have that part of it to see if what you're doing is having an effect, and then understanding what you can do to either mitigate or adapt to that effect. So the answer is absolutely it needs to be part of it. Should it go through periodic revisions? Absolutely. Because to be adaptive, you have to learn as you go. And you're going to learn that some things become more important to either the managers or the public or to the ecosystem itself than it was when you started out on the journey. So as a case in point, we've spent an awful lot of time, effort, and money on the beaches in the Grand Canyon. Should we continue to monitor them at the intensity that they've been monitored over the past since 96? I would say probably not. We've learned a significant amount about the beaches, and we know the processes that are driving their formation and loss, their erosion. And we know a fair amount about what floods will do. Now, we learned a lot from 96, never having done one of those ever in the world before. On purpose, so you could have scientists pre, during, and post evaluate it. We learned that how we did it was not necessarily the best way to do it. And we've learned from that and now have adapted to that. Do we need to continue to do them? Well, I think that to me is more of a societal question in some respect. Because do you want beaches in the Grand Canyon for river runners, etc.? I can tell you I want beaches for the riparian. I want sediment there. For the riparian zone, for the birds, for the lizards. I want them to build backwaters for fish, etc. More than I want them for beaches for camping on, even though beaches for camping on are great. So it's these societal desires or objectives I think need to be looked at periodically and recalibrated. Should we be putting, you know, now I think to me the more important portion that if I were there running it, I'd be looking into is the impact of climate change downstream. Because, you know, I was just up there in, was it May, for NAU had asked me to come up and talk about adaptive management to a bunch of Brazilians who are working on developing an adaptive management program for the Amazon River. So I went up and then I spent the day, I went up to the dam with them, we did a float. I was amazed how much that system has changed up there because of the aquatic plants that are in the system now that weren't there before, what's lost from the system, and how the riparian zone has changed. Part of that, a large part of that
between
is...
Between the dam and Lee's Ferry, I'm assuming?
Exactly.
Okay.
Part of that is due to the fact we've had low reservoir elevations in Powell,
uh-huh.
which has brought warmer water downstream.
Uh-huh.
Some invasive species have gotten in.
Tamarisk.
Well, tamarisks for one, I'm more worried now about quagga mussel and a few other species like that. There's some salamander that Larry Stevens has found up there now that we're not sure if it's a native or if it's an exotic. So, but to me, the value of having the adaptive management program there and the fact that you're integrating it with what I would consider one of the jewels of the National Park Service, Grand Canyon National Park, sandwiched between two big reservoirs that are feeling direct impacts of climate change because of lower hydrology, lower water levels. To me, this is an area that we should be nationally, internationally embracing for looking at it in the term, the context of changes that are coming out that are due to whether it's man or just natural process going on. We need to be able to tease these things apart. We have a rich data set to be able to do that with. So do we need to keep monitoring the beaches as much? Probably not as much. I think we can get that honed down a little bit. Should we continue to put effort into the humpback chub? Absolutely. It's an endangered fish for a reason. It's limited in where it can live in the Colorado River system. This is one spot we want to make sure we take care of it and get second population well established, et cetera, et cetera. Should we continue to do work with the Native Americans and the archaeology? Absolutely. It's there. You cannot imagine the pushback I got from the Bureau of Reclamation for bringing the 8 tribes on board. Absolutely. It's one of the times I was fired. My boss out of Salt Lake came down and said, we brought him down to a meeting, I think it was at Kaikosmoe in the Hopis, and he said, I never want to go into another one of those meetings again. I think it's absolutely worthless, his words, to have the tribes involved. All they're going to do is cost us money and time, and you're not to interact with them anymore. And I said, I am going to interact with them. We're in a NEPA process. They are a constituent. They have a right. We've blown them off from the very beginning. You're damn right I'm going to keep meeting with them. He said, well, I'm going to have to fire you if you don't obey me. So I called, I shouldn't tell you this, but I called George, and George did an end around on some people and
helped protected me. For a little while.
But you can't, well, NEPA requires you to consult. You don't get to pick who you consult with.
And there are laws requiring consultation
exactly.
with tribes when management impacts their resources and interests.
And the Bureau never even talked to them. When you think about Lake Powell, when they built Glen Canyon Dam, they had what was called a salvage study above the dam. On the north side of what would be the reservoir, the University of Utah collected all the stuff they could get as the waters were literally rising.
Archaeological,
cultural baskets, you know, things like south side, it was the Museum of Northern Arizona. So you had Ned Danson and his crews, they were just out there picking this stuff as literally as the water was rising. That was to the Bureau, that was consultation. That's not consultation. You need to go to Window Rock and sit through an 8-hour council meeting where they're speaking Navajo, and maybe they'll speak English for 2 minutes to you at some point. But you need to be there. You need to be let them part of the process. But neither here. So I think that part of it continues to be important to me, and I think it should be to the nation, because the tribes are an integral part of this part of the country, of the world. So it's important.
A related question that I had was, what did you want to accomplish when you were involved that you were unable to?
Well, I didn't know what we were going to accomplish. So I guess all of it is good. I think how it ended up in terms of structure, I would have done a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But again,
what do you mean by that? What kind of?
Well, I'll just take as an example, the organization of the Adaptive Management Committee. There were two environmental seats. There were a whole bunch of seats for the water users, the electrical users, you know, other folks, agency administrators, etc. To have two people who represented the environmental community, to me, and there was nobody there representing the science community. They were part of the technical work group, but they didn't have a voting seat at the committee.
And when was that?
Well, that was when they set it up in 96. They were starting set up in 96, implemented in 97.
seems like things have changed quite a bit since.
They've changed a bit. I mean, I think that the users have still more power than the conservation entities, and certainly more than the science entities do. I would also say that adaptive, the process, like any process, over time will tend to get insulated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happened to some extent. How do you get out of that insulation? The Everglades, when we saw that in the Everglades, what we did is we set up
Is that the re-meandering of the Kissimmee River? That
well, that's part of it, but there's this else? Is actually getting more water to the river grass.
Okay.
So the unwinding or winding, rewinding the Kissimmee was a Corps of Engineer project, but there's bigger parts of that. There's the water quality of Lake Okeechobee
mm-hmm.
is part of that. What we do with Hoover Dyke is part of that. What we do with opening up the ability to move water south to the Everglades, so opening up roads, building elevated roads so the water can pass through without mm-hmm. getting ponded up. It's all part of that. But what we did there was that every 2 years, the Academy of Sciences comes in and does a broad oversight of, are we still on the right track?
They're evaluating
yeah.
the science, or they're evaluating
they evaluate
management
the science and the management, you know,
okay.
kind of look at it in a broad 50,000-foot view. I think you need to have periodic check-ins to make sure you're still moving in the right direction that Congress directed you to do, that the science is coming in and showing you to do, and that the agencies and the public are expecting you to do. So I think periodic resets
uh-huh.
of sorts would be a value added to the process. And certainly if you see now other places where adaptive management is being implemented more successfully, you have periodic resets.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to make that sound like you go in and change everything. And it may be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, I don't know what the magic number is. But you come in and open yourself up to peer review, just as we as scientists would. If you're writing a paper, you get outside people to give you input to make sure you're still moving in the same direction. So I think increasing exposure of science and conservation on the adaptive management work group would be appropriate. And I think having periodic reviews would be two things right off the top of my head that I would think of.
A little earlier, you mentioned that there are three prongs to adaptive management. You mentioned the scientific research being one prong, the administration of the program and the agency's management actions is another, and then public participation.
Public participation and education.
And education.
Yeah.
Do you have any opinions about how the three of those prongs intersect? Are there times when one is more powerful than the other?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get them to work well together and integrate? Because you want the science to inform the management, and you want the public to be satisfied.
Right.
And that doesn't always happen. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship of those prongs?
Well, you're absolutely right. They do kind of jumpstart, and some will be further ahead or further behind than the others at certain times. Again, when we were designing this test, this experiment of sorts, didn't have a lot of to go on, so we're kind of making it up as we went, and that's where Steve played a really key role in this, because he would kind of keep feeding ideas to a certain extent on this, or questioning. He was sometimes my biggest critic. What are we trying to do here, and why are you trying to do that sort of thing? But I think all of them are necessary, and it's inevitable that some will have to take precedent over others at certain points in the process. That being said, I think if I were to do it over again, I think the scientists were hard at the beginning, but once you got them on board, they kind of got it, why we're doing adaptive management and how. Now, that being said, we still have agency scientists who are driven by the latest cooperative agreement requirements, etc. So you need to make sure there are scientists there who think at different levels, some that are at the 5,000 foot, some that are at the 30,000, some at the 50,000. the value of the Academy of Science at the 50,000 to kind of make sure you're still moving in the right direction for the right reasons, sort of thing. So that science needs to move forward, and there needs to be bridges or intersections back and forth. The administration part of it, once they were forced to embrace the concept, then you have to educate them on what it means and how it's going to impact and be applied. Part of what we ended up doing as part of the adaptive management program is that every month I would get on an airplane and I would either drive to Page or to fly to Montrose, Colorado, where Western Area Power Administration's offices were, still are. And we would sit down monthly and we'd talk about, this is what the science needs to have in terms of dam operations for this next month. Or, you know, we'd look out 3 months, but we'd, you know, always had a 3 month kind of moving forward average. And we'd talk about what that meant to the guy who sits at the control at the base on floor 9 in the control room at Glen Canyon Dam. Because I wanted to have them feel they were part of the process. So, and that was one of the smartest things we did, is Dick White, who ran the power office at Glen Canyon Dam, it was his guys who were at the gauges, and he had me come in and talk to him. So they knew why this bunch of crazy scientists were downstream doing this and why what they did was important. Now, did they agree with what we were doing? I would say probably 90% of the time they didn't, but they understood why we were doing it. So again, on an administrative level, you got to get to the 5,000, the 20,000, and the 50,000 level, the regional directors and the executive review committee. They have to be working with you and not against you. And I made a few mistakes and had them working against me on certain occasions. So that doesn't help. And then the public and the education prong of this. The public needs to keep the public working with you. Not necessarily agreeing with you, but understanding what you're doing. We had, like I say, when we were sued twice by Trout Unlimited for the first experimental flood, because the trout fishermen were convinced that we were going to destroy the trout fishery below Glen Canyon Dam with a flood. They had seen what happened in 83. 83 was a whole different deal than 96. You wouldn't think 13 years would have that big a difference, but already the ecosystem had changed more because of how Arizona Game and Fish was managing the fishery than it had to do with the flood push. The fish moved to the side. They know where to go when high water comes. They weren't being flushed downstream. But
during the experimental flood, mm-hmm. what was the effect on the trout fishery?
Very little.
No.
Ultimately, no.
Okay.
What it affected was their food base in terms of the cladophora getting picked up and pushed away.
Just let you know that thing's 5 minutes slow.
Okay.
Okay, we got about 25 minutes before we close.
Okay, thank you.
Directions will be locked at 5 till 5.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
So the Trout Unlimited piece is you got to keep educating the public as you learn and make sure the information gets out to them, whether it's in public fluff pieces or NPR, or you got to keep educating as you move along here through the process.
And what do we gain when all of that is working?
You get the public trusting what the government's doing, maybe not always agreeing with it, but understanding why they're doing that. There's one important part of this that I think, though being in the government, they would say you don't need this, but I think you do. I think you need to have a point person, who a spokesperson of sorts, who the public trusts, being able to have that dialogue with the public and with the politicians and with the scientists. So as hard as it is for a person, if you're working in the government never wants to have a person be the point person, so to speak. You're all part of the broader group. It's important that you do cultivate leadership in that arena. Somebody who's good speaking and who can communicate. It's critical that they communicate. So
we gain trust because of the transparency and the collaborative engagement with stakeholders.
Yeah.
That's an important
But you have to be consistent. You can't just show up, you know, for one decision, for one meeting when you need a decision like the next day. And you can't let the public, if the public thinks You're just there checking a box. That's the worst thing you can do. You've got to be working them way before that.
And how about accomplishments? I mean, we've got a couple of decades of research and adaptive management. What would you say has improved as a result of this work?
We know more about the Grand Canyon. We have a lot more science now. I think there is an understanding that the agencies need to work together. They don't always do that, but that there is a forum for them to have that discussion. It's unfortunate, in my opinion, and this is mine alone, that depending on the administration and who they have as their secretarial representative, sometimes it's collaborative, sometimes it's dictatorial. They'll tell you it's collaborative, but it's checking off a box, and they're just basically, this is how we're going to do this, no matter what you tell me, sort of thing. So you need to be. I would say that we've gotten more science. We do have a forum, and it's a proven forum now for discussion and dialogue. I don't believe we've fully embraced everything we should with the tribes yet. Part of that is we don't fund the tribes to participate, and the tribes got to come up with their own bucks. Most of these tribes don't have the dollars to participate at the level of the Fish and Wildlife Service or Western Area Power Administration or CREDA or people who have a checkbook. They don't have a checkbook. And I think that's part of it, that if I would have had something to say in this that I'd go back and change, it would be that the United States government would support the Native American groups' involvement and engagement in this.
You'd like to see that added.
I would have put that in there,
just
because of the role that the United States government has with our sovereign nations, the tribes. Just because I see that they aren't often given the credibility or the ability to interface at the level of CREDA or the level of the Salt River Project or any of the other stakeholders who have a trained staff, who have a checkbook to travel, go to meetings, to be participants. The tribes just don't have that capacity. And that was the nice thing. We started with the Glen Canyon studies. It wasn't continued. But where the EPA money came in, we were able to bring in money from EPA to start training tribal staff because they had the tribal program. And we used that to get the Hualapai spooled up, their natural resources department, the Hopi, the San Juan Pai. That's the money that started those programs, all was seed money we got from EPA, and we brought it in and just rolled it up. And you know, I think that's important.
As a result of that increasing involvement and collaboration with tribes, do you think that operations at Glen Canyon Dam have been altered in a way that is beneficial to archaeological resources or cultural resources in the Grand Canyon?
I would say that we're still seeing erosion of a lot of those resources.
Slower erosion than otherwise?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think it varies. I remember sitting at the salt mine beach below the confluence of the Little Colorado with Farrell Sakakaku when he was still alive and was chairman of the Hopi tribe. We were doing a river trip together. Mark Reisner was on the trip with us. Another tangent. I took Mark Reisner on his first tour of Glen Canyon Dam. This was after he had written Cadillac Desert. He had never been to Glen Canyon Dam before he wrote Cadillac Desert. And we became friends after he wrote the book, and we took him on a river trip. But anyway, Farrell and I were sitting there, and you know, it's just to the Hopis, it's not necessarily a location or a rock or a beach. It's the area. So to him, any change, any impact the dam is having is a change that is not natural. So, yeah, it's continuing to impact their resources. Those beaches are getting smaller. We did, you know, as part of the EIS, I had crews that literally walked from Glen Canyon Dam to Lake Mead on both sides of the river. Every foot from Glen, think about that. Glen, and I had Jan Balsam in the Park Service hire people to do this, but That's, they walked it every foot.
I didn't even think that was possible.
You wouldn't think, but they did it. And they, we had boats. Well, you know, I had so many river trips on the water. It's just amazing. But, you know, that level of science has never been done anywhere else before. So you think about it. Is it everything that it could be? No. Is it better than it would have been? Absolutely. Does it have promise for the future? Of course, yeah. We just got to keep building on it and keep working it and not let it just become a checkbox, in my opinion. But that's not what we intended when we put the Grand Canyon Protection Act together. It's called the Grand Canyon Protection Act for a reason. It's to protect the Grand Canyon forever, perpetuity.
I think that's a great place to end the interview,
okay.
Don't you?
I do.
Pretty good.